And also the Atlantic Pharmacy used a particular program that matched interactions with various medications and dosages of various medications, and just approving the prescription itself would not necessarily have raised a red flag.
But aren't you just rebutting the red flag testimony? Your point is that the government exceeded the scope of what they said this witness would talk about, but the government said that Kazarian would not testify about quality or usefulness of the CPCs that he reviewed. And I just, if you could point me to a single place in the record where Kazarian testified to the quality or usefulness of the CPCs.
Well, yes. What he testified about violated the ex post facto clause because he knew the statements he used in his testimony were taken directly from the mandatory training continuing education that came into effect post the alleged indicted offenses occurred.
But you're talking right there about the law change. What I'm asking about is you've raised the issue of whether the government's witness exceeded the scope of what he was supposed to testify about. And I'm not sure where in the record he did so.
He misstated opinions about dosage. The formulations under the statute are technical matters. He should have testified about what he knew about, and he did not. And the statute did not require the assessment of prescriptions for appropriate therapeutic value, yet he asserted that was what was required.
So I guess I'm still just asking you to point to something in the record about where, when the government said he wouldn't testify about the quality or usefulness of the CPCs, where do you say he did so?
I'm looking at volume 572 of the record, page 123 to 24. Also docket entry 316 at page 45.
And so what is he saying on those? Can you read to me what you're quoting?
Well, he was talking about the law that had not been enacted yet. And he also, when he testified about this, about the 85-year-old patient and the young child, that was outside the scope and nature of what had been agreed by the parties and the court would be his testimony.
Okay, so you're
one of the defendants.
So you're pointing to the 85-year-old, 10-year-old issue, and then the recently enacted law. That's what you're pointing to.
That is correct.
Okay.
And in.
Oh, and you have exceeded your time. I took you over time. Oh. So we are going to proceed to Mr. Upson, and you have 5 minutes.
May it please the court, Keith Upson for appellate Patrick Tong. Though the court's made me suddenly realize just because I pronounce it Tong doesn't necessarily mean I'm correct, which is part of the bane of appellate practice. We read all day and interact very little with other humans. Good morning, and thank you for allowing us to appear this way. We briefed plain error as to the course of deliberations issue for the simple reason counsel was absolutely silent when the district judge said we have a Category 5 hurricane headed straight toward us. On that note, it's unclear to me what portion of the record supports the government's assertion that Hurricane Irma was a tropical storm, because what the court said was Category 5 at sidebar when they were discussing it.
Well, and I remember Irma, and I remember it was a big deal. But as far as the record shows, at trial, both defense counsel seemed happy to let the jury continue deliberating. How is this not invited error?
Well, Judge, that's not too factually dissimilar from some otherwise very factually dissimilar facts this court more recently addressed in Brewster. And if I may hold the response to that a little further into my 3 minutes and 50 seconds, I promise I'll address it. Because here not only did counsel stay silent at the time, Category 5 headed straight our way came out of the trial judge's mouth. They continued to remain silent. They remained silent after the jury returned a verdict. But under plain error review, you know, we've got to move that rock up that mountain and show there was error, that it was plain and it affected substantial rights.
And I'm sure you know, well, I assume you would agree with me that I haven't been able to see that any circuit has ever held that an impending weather event constituted coercion per se. So if you could address that as well.
Not that I could find, Judge. And if I could have found it, if I could have found one on all fours factually, shame on me if it wasn't first and foremost in the brief and at argument, but I couldn't. And of course, the government found Lucas, for an example, actually where the hurricane, if I read Lucas correctly, Lucas versus American, the hurricane was literally impacting the courthouse at the time the court was going to give the case to the jury. But Lucas was decided in November of 1980. I don't think it's clear from the opinion when Lucas was tried or which storm they're referring to.
Let me ask you, ask you a question. So I was actually surprised at how much hurricane case law there was. Uh-huh. But it seemed like the problem, you know, whenever you're at the end of a trial, the jury wants to go home, right? That's been my experience at every trial that I've ever been in. They don't want to stay the extra day. They don't want to come back. They just want to get it done. It seems like the only problem, if there was a hurricane, would be if the judge had hurried them up, had eliminated some option and said, you know, we're not going to come back. You have to stay all night. Or if the judge had, in that one case, said, you know, you only have 15 minutes to get the verdict because there's a hurricane. Was there anything that the judge did in this case that hurried the jury to get a verdict or made it so that they were coerced into returning a verdict?
Judge, I apologize if this isn't clear in the brief, but it's our position that the act of giving the case to the jury at the point the court gave it to the jury is a sufficient act of coercion necessary under the rule and on the rights this court discussed in Brewster. So
yeah, but it's like a bright line hurricane rule that you would propose?
Not at all. And we recognize that asking you to extend the rights, the substantial rights of the defendants to not have that pressure on the jury while they deliberate, be extended from Brewster to these facts, it's not at all something you can do on a bright line basis. You're going to have to do it on a case-by-case basis. It's going to have to be very fact-dependent. But we continue to maintain that on the totality of the circumstances here, the act of giving the case to the jury with a Category 5 headed straight for them created sufficient substantial risk. One or more jurors were going to abandon their honest convictions, which in turn denied the defendants of their substantial rights to an uncoerced verdict.
Well, what about giving a case to the jury the day before, like, a three-day holiday, you know, a three-day weekend? I mean, would that be coercion because they don't want to come back on Tuesday? They want to have a good three-day weekend?
Judge, I appreciate that in this context, it sounds like an absurd position, but you and I both know some trial attorneys, some appellate, somebody's going to make that argument at some point. But the nature of being in the cone of impact from a Category 5 storm is so factually above and beyond. One of the things that the government says about how the jury returned their verdict, you know, 4 days before Irma made landfall, and I laughed, though it wasn't funny, because of course they did. That's the entire point. You have to take preparations in advance. If you're going to evacuate, you can't wait until all the gas stations are out of gas. If you're going to board up and weather it in place, that takes time to do. And you can't do that in tropical storm force winds. You have to do it in advance.
Was an evacuation order in place at the time that the jury was ordered to proceed to consideration?
It's my understanding from the record and the black letters on the white page that the district court said there was discussion that the mayor may begin ordering evacuations the following day.
And counsel, counsel, you know I'm going to bring you back to my question that you promised you would address later on, and that's at trial. Counsel for the defendants were both happy to let the jury continue deliberating, and they offered to assist in whatever way they could to avoid a mistrial. And if those defense counsel weren't distracted, why should we assume the jury was?
Because they were tired and sick of it as well. And I think if we apply Occam's razor, what's the more likely situation after 3 weeks of trial? Did they really think they were going to get acquittals, or did they just want to be done with it?
And but once again, if that's the standard, I mean, have you ever sat through an 8-week trial? I mean, that's the thing. I mean, that, if that's the standard, the jury didn't want to really deliberate all that much and they wanted to go home and the defense counsel was tired. I mean, I just don't see how that's something we could apply. I get that there's a hurricane involved here, but it just seems like the kinds of stuff we're talking about is just kind of the human factors that go into every trial that has ever been tried.
Well, I know I'm over, but I promised, too, I would come back to what was factually similar with Brewster, and it was a 2254. So, of course, it was a state court proceeding. But in Brewster, this court said where defense counsel similarly sat there like a potted plant and said nothing. You know what? Under these facts and circumstances, we can't say that jury wasn't coerced.
Was there an Allen charge here?
There was no Allen charge here, and so I believe there were at least
important difference between this case and Brewster, right?
It's the distinction between why I'm not trying to persuade the court that Brewster is facially controlling precedent. It's why I'm asking this court to extend the recognition of those rights and the rule announced in Brewster to circumstances such as this where there was no Allen charge.
All right, and counsel, you have exceeded your time. You've still got time for rebuttal, so we're going to move to the government. Ms. Mariani.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Assistant United States Attorney Nicole Mariani on behalf of the United States. While defendants have raised several issues at argument, all of them are subject to either harmless error or plain error review and can be easily resolved by looking to the overwhelming evidence presented by the government's 46 trial witnesses, many of whom were defendants' co-conspirators or employees. Those witnesses testified that defendants stole over $31 million in less than 2 years from TRICARE, the insurance provider for the United States military and the Federal Employee Health Benefit Program, by filing insurance claims that they knew were fraudulent. And each claim had a trio of independent fraud within it. And those witnesses also testified that defendants knowingly and willfully paid kickbacks to doctors and patients. Ample circumstantial evidence corroborated that testimony. Turning more specifically to that overwhelming evidence of guilt, defendant's scheme was rooted in a multi-level fraud. First, every claim filed by Atlantic was fraudulent, because Atlantic was admitted to the insurance networks under false pretenses as Francois lied, saying he had never been disciplined by the DEA, saying he had never filed for bankruptcy, and saying he had never paid a subcontractor more than $25,000 in a year. Second, every compound prescription cream filed by Atlantic was fraudulent because Atlantic did not collect the required copayments. And there was a third independent basis for the fraud in every compound prescription claim filed by Atlantic, which was that the underlying prescriptions were invalid because there was no legitimate doctor-patient relationship, the prescriptions were medically unnecessary, and they were often shipped to patients in states where Atlantic was not licensed. Indeed, we have five co-conspirators who testified that Atlantic did not collect those requirement copayments. You have three co-conspirators who testified that defendants knew they were filing fraudulent claims, including because Tong, who was Francois's used car salesman, personal trainer, and occasional nanny with no medical background, was creating the formulas that these physicians were being required to prescribe. And you have six co-conspirators who testified that defendants knowingly and willfully paid kickbacks to the doctors and patients, including Sincere and Meek, who testified they repeatedly told Francois and Tong that they were using the money Atlantic gave them to pay doctors and patients. This court has held that co-conspirator testimony alone would be sufficient to uphold convictions. But in this case, that testimony was then overwhelmingly corroborated. You have five patients testifying that the Atlantic never collected co-payments or requested co-payments for them for these compound prescription creams. You have Dr. Heyman testifying that he told Francois three times he was filling forged prescriptions. Francois then continued to fill 15 more such prescriptions and worked with a recruiter who provided them for years. Tom's emails and texts showed he created the formulas he was sending to these physicians to prescribe, and that he knew Atlantic, that these recruiters were taking the money Atlantic paid them to pay physicians and doctors. Francois testifies in his own defense that he knew nothing about the fraud or paying of kickbacks, and the jury was entitled to credit that substantive evidence of his guilt. And then there's also a mountain of circumstantial evidence showing that Francois and Tong committed healthcare fraud and paid kickbacks. You know, the fraud at Atlantic was obvious. You have pharmacist Nader Henry who quits after 3 months because it's so clear these prescriptions are invalid, yet Francois is filling all of the prescriptions that he rejected. You have Dr. Garcia sending over 2,400 prescriptions in a matter of months to Atlantic, all providing the same sets of formulas to each patient. Many of these patients are members of the same family. Many of these patients live in states that are far away from his office and where Atlantic is not licensed. Atlantic is receiving daily returns of prescriptions with patients calling to say they don't want them. They don't know who this doctor is. And Francois and Tong were certainly aware of this. Francois is the sole owner of Atlantic. Francois and Tong were there every single day. Francois is the only signatory on the bank accounts where all of the fraud proceeds are deposited. And Francois are the only, and Tong are the only two people to withdraw those fraud proceeds for personal gain. Then they also took many steps to conceal their crimes. They direct others to convince patients to keep online prescriptions. They alert co-conspirators when the Board of Pharmacy is auditing Atlantic. They direct others to repackage and ship their prescriptions to states where they are not licensed. They direct Simcere to pay all our kickbacks in cash to avoid detection. They ask Meek and Small to file W-4 forms to show that they're employees. When law enforcement came to search Atlantic, they concealed room 109 and then removed the computers and phones out of that room. They go to employee Lee's home and tell her mother to make sure Lee does not incriminate them. They direct the Simcere's to delete and shred all their documents. And then Tong deletes all of his texts and emails. So in sum, you have Francois and Tong are playing a daily and active role in the healthcare and fraud conspiracies. The conviction was supported by evidence so overwhelming that any of these alleged trial errors, if there were errors, which the government maintains there were no errors, they would be harmless, and they certainly could not have affected their substantial rights. Now, moving over to what Ms. Lowenthal was talking about with expert witness Kazarian, as the court noted in the expert notice, the government said that Kazarian would testify about red flags. That is precisely what he testified about. Sort of the evidence she's pointing to where he spoke about the 85-year-old and the 11-year-old. Expert Kazarian testified it was a red flag that an 85-year-old and an 11-year-old were receiving the same medication dosage, explaining that you want to make sure a medication is adjusted and that as we age, our bodies change. That statement does not reference whether the medication prescribed to either the child or the senior citizen was effective, was correct, or was proper. All he was testifying was, it is concerning. It raises a suspicion that you give the exact same thing to two people who are so obviously disparate using our common sense. And then also going to what Ms. Lowenthal raised about the red...
Speaking only for myself, I think I'm on board with your argument about the Kazarian testimony. I did have one question about the 404B evidence. You say that the stipulation constituted invited error, but hadn't the court already indicated that it was going to allow the evidence in? I don't see how that can be the stipulation made after the court indicated that it would let the evidence in could be considered invited error.
Yes, I think that's a very good point the court makes. Is again, like they had stipulated to how it would come in, but yes, that this was sort of after they've been told it is coming in. There is a degree of, it raises a question because they stipulated it in this way to make sure sort of further more detrimental evidence did not come in. But I think regardless of whether the invited error doctrine applies, this evidence was properly admitted under 404B as showing motive, intent, and knowledge. It's, you know, sort of the precise replica of the type of fraud they committed in this case. And certainly, as I explained before, it is harmless error. With the absolutely overwhelming evidence in this case, the defendants committed all of the crimes of which they were convicted. And then the last thing, turning to Tong's argument about Hurricane Irma, as the court pointed out, the parties at trial, they did not sit there quietly as if potted plants and not respond. This was an active discussion with the court where you have both defense counsel explicitly stating that they wanted the jury to stay and continue deliberating. They came together with the government to pay the rental car fee for one of the jurors so that the jury could stay and continue deliberating. This jury deliberated for over 14 hours over the course of a Friday and a Tuesday and reached split verdicts as to both defendants. And again, as the court pointed out, there is not a current storm. Yes, Hurricane Irma was coming. It was very dramatic. People needed to prepare. The jury was deliberating on Friday and Tuesday. The storm hit over the weekend. There was no jury charge in place, putting any kind of time limit on the deliberations. And unlike the cases in Lucas and some of the others, there was not a factually impossible verdict. Instead, as we've been talking about, this jury deliberated undisturbed for 14 hours over 2 days, where they saw absolutely overwhelming evidence from 46 witnesses who presided consistent testimony that were corroborated by the documents and by including Tom's own texts and emails.
Can I ask you to address something really quickly? Opposing counsel said that the government's notice for Kazarian was came too late. Could you address that?
Absolutely. I do want to know that issue was not raised in defense counsel's briefs. What had occurred was Kazarian's notice was provided 17 days before trial began. And also to note, Kazarian did not testify until the 9th day of trial. So he did not testify until 26 days after that notice was provided. Before the district court, I believe Francois did challenge the timeliness of his notice. The district court denied that challenge. That was certainly not an abuse of discretion, given not only the 26 days, but that the government and the district court offered Francois a continuance if he would like to get more time to obtain an expert on his own behalf. He stated he did not. He explicitly declined the continuance and said he wanted to proceed to trial. And that is the extent to which that issue was sort of raised below. And it's certainly the government's position that with 26 days testimony about sort of red flag prescriptions, which is fairly standard in these kind of healthcare fraud cases, is certainly enough notice for the defendant to prepare and obtain a witness should he want to. And he chose not to accept the continuance. If the court has no further questions, the government will rest on its brief and ask that Francois and Tong's convictions be affirmed. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Lowenthal, you have reserved 2 minutes for rebuttal.
You're muted.
Ms. Lowenthal, you're muted.
No, thank you. With regard to 46 witnesses who testified, yes, many of those were convicted criminals. Many of them had motive to lie or embellish their testimony because they were hoping to get reduced sentences. And in fact, the key witness, Mrs. Simcere, was shown in cross-examination to have lied to the government on several occasions. With regard to the 404B evidence and the alleged lies in Mr. Francois' applications to various entities for recertification of his pharmacy, those occurred mainly in 2010. Number one, they were mistakes, or they were actually the correct answer to the specific question that was asked. And his license was once disciplined for a mistaken refill, but it was never, he was never disciplined. His license was never suspended. His license was never revoked. And the same for the other questions, such as bankruptcy. Yes, he once filed for bankruptcy, but that proceeding was dismissed. There was never any finding in bankruptcy or any holding. There was no bankruptcy proceedings that took place for Mr. Francois. In addition, these alleged lies on the applications occurred in 2010, and the government alleges that that was somehow fraudulently that those were fraudulently part of a conspiracy to defraud insurer payors in 4 years later, which just makes no sense at all. With regard to the jury, and I will not take Mr. Upson's issue, but there were 15 days of trial over almost 1 month. One of the jurors was a school principal, and she said that on that day, the day of deliberations, the second day, her phone was blowing up. That is literally that's from the transcript from her school employees about what they were to do to secure the school properties for the impending hurricane.
And,
so,
and Ms. Lowenthal,
it is doubtful that she was. Oh, yes,
Ms. Lowenthal, you've exceeded your time, so I'm gonna stop you there. Mr. Upson, you have 2 minutes.
Thank you. The government's not going to try a case that's a close call as to the volume of the evidence they present, right? I mean, that's, I've never seen it. This case was no different. It was extensively tried, and I understand the jury spoke as to those fact questions in their verdict. But can we say with sufficient certainty the verdicts were a product of the jurors following their oath? Or because a minority of the jurors sacrificed their conscientious scruples for the sake of reaching agreement with a Category 5 hurricane headed straight for them. It certainly created a substantial risk one or more jurors would abandon their honest convictions. We expect the jurors to be reasonable, though, right? I mean, there's no presumption that they're superhuman or ability to divorce their thoughts or concerns from all awareness of the imminent hurricane. I don't think it would be reasonable to expect savvy jurors to send out a note that says, hey, we're thinking about acting contrary to our oath. So the fact they didn't ask for more time, I don't think is illustrative. They didn't want more time. They wanted to get out of the courthouse and deal with this very real impending threat, such to an extent that we're asking this court to extend Brewster to the facts at bar on the totality of the circumstances here, giving the case to the jury with that storm heading straight for them at the time the court said so, created a substantial risk. One or more jurors were going to abandon their honest convictions and in turn deny the defendants their substantial right to an uncoerced verdict. And we ask the court to vacate the judgments and sentences and remand for a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Upson. Thanks to all of you. We have your case under submission. So the next case, our last case of the day,